All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. And welcome to episode 20 of the SLS Cast, one episode away from being legally able to drink. If this episode thing were a person and we were dealing in years.
That didn't work as well as your 18.
No, opening. It didn't. But, you know, they can't all be winners, can they?
They can't.
No, that's right. So,
that's kind of like life itself whenever you do turn 21. I mean, you kind of realize that.
This is very true, very true. So, how you been since last week?
I'm doing well. I kind of got stuck on a plane for a while in Phoenix on the way back to California from Houston. But other than that, doing well. It was a nice U.S. Airways flight back. U.S. Airways actually has one of the nicer planes, I think, than United. For the most part. I don't mean like the big United planes are obviously nice, but the smaller U.S. Airways compared to the United smaller U.S. Airways, I think, are far more superior.
Well, cool.
I guess. I don't know.
Well, I was recently on United and flew out to Orlando on a 737, I think, and that was cool. And then came back on it was supposed to be an A20 or something. I can't, like Lockheed Martin something, but it ended up being a 727. So it worked out both ways for me.
Good.
Yeah. I haven't been on U.S. Airways ever that I can think of. So I will defer to your judgment on that, sir.
I don't blame you. It was only my first time, my first trip on U.S. Airways. So.
Right on.
Who knows? They might have more crappy planes, and I just got lucky.
This is true. I don't know. Hey, you know, when I was growing up, I flew a lot on American and then switched over to Delta and then a little bit more on Continental, but now it's all United. So, yeah, United is the last two flights that I've taken or the last two times that I've flown last year and a few weeks ago. I got to say, I'm good with United for now, but such is life. So this has been nice and boring. I just really don't think anybody gives a flying fuck about our about our opinions on U.S. Airways versus United.
We could start again.
Nah, let's just let it be all awkward and stupid. Then we can go news. Lead off, sir.
All right, so for this news portion of the show, I actually have some, opposed to the two I had last week. One and a half, I'll give it that. Now, I'm going to start off with a couple Michael Bay portions of news, which I think are kind of interesting. And you know what? This allows me to like him a little bit more for what he does during the second portion of this news, what I'm about to tell you. Now, Michael Bay, a couple days ago, we're recording on Tuesday, April 23rd, and this happened on the 21st. Michael Bay was inducted into the Tough Guy Hall of Fame that Alamo Drafthouse was putting on because I guess they just really, I don't know, they wanted to throw an event for him, and they wanted this event to be as big as Michael Bay himself. They were doing all these different, you know, showing all these movies of his, so I'm sure Armageddon and The Rock, I'm sure, maybe, just all this stuff all day long. And they called this event Baymageddon, the Baymageddon event. So that was just in honor of Michael Bay himself. Now, in saying that, only one day after the event, Michael Bay issued a letter to the Miami Herald apologizing for his film Armageddon. Now, I'm going to read this portion of the letter. Actually, I don't know if it's the whole letter or whatnot, but this is what they have on Cinema Blend. It says, quote, "I will apologize for Armageddon because we had to do this whole movie in 16 weeks, which I didn't know. It was a massive undertaking. That was not fair to the movie. I would redo the entire third act if I could, but the studio literally took the movie away from us. It was terrible. My visual effects supervisor had a nervous breakdown, so I had to be in charge of that. I called James Cameron and asked, what to do when you are doing all the effects yourself, but the movie did fine. So it's not often where you actually see a director issuing an apology about a previous movie of theirs, especially from a guy like Michael Bay. I would never have thought that in a million years that he would admit to doing something wrong. Because usually with a director, depending on what kind of director it is, if they put out crap, or if they failed at doing something, or just a bad movie, they'll just say, well, you know, it's in the past, I can't do anything about it. But then you have perfectionists like Oliver Stone, who goes back and does like 20 different cuts of Alexander, that I believe they just came out with a new one this past year. Like, literally, it's like the fifth director's cut of that movie. So, you know, a tip of the hat to Michael Bay for apologizing for Armageddon. And, I don't know, did you know it? They had to make it in 16 weeks?
I did not. I
mean, it's a big special effects movie, too.
I will say that, and I don't know, I guess maybe I was young and dumb then, but I liked Armageddon. I haven't seen it in, like, 10 years, but I did like it when it first came out. I remember liking it.
Yeah, we talked about this a few weeks ago.
Yes, we did.
You liked Armageddon, I liked Deep Impact. So, yeah. Now, moving on, we have Transformers 4. Now, I reported, as I do, I report the news, and I sure as hell was not the first one to figure any of this out, so I didn't report shit. Now, what I read earlier, a few episodes ago, or what I read to you a few episodes ago, was that Transformers 4 were going to outsource some of its characters and some of the filming in China to appease the Chinese market, because that's a multi-billion dollar movie going ticket price market out there.
Yes.
So what they're doing to cast, I think it's 3 or 4 Chinese actors, and I'll say 4 actors, they're doing a reality TV show as a contest to figure out who will be the right person to be in Transformers 4. And they launched a press conference in Beijing on Thursday, and I guess announcing all this stuff. And it turns out that these type of shows, these reality TV shows, is like the top, like one of the top 3 shows over there. It's a big thing. So I guess anybody who's anybody watches a game show or a talk show, or not a talk show, a game show or a reality TV show over in Asia. So it's a big thing. So whenever people are making fun of the Asians for being on game shows, like that Chris Farley one, that skit on SNL, when Mike Myers is the Asian guy hosting the Chinese game show, and if you get the question wrong or you answer it wrong, you die. Like a horrible, awkward death. But apparently, stuff like that happens. I mean, they have a lot of weird shit over there. But I digress. So yes, that's interesting. The Chinese are going to basically audition via a reality TV show. I would just love to see what kind of games they have them do. Like, if they have to go through any obstacles, like running from debris, or dodging fireballs or bullets, or something like that.
I don't know. Perhaps maybe they just are made to sit through Transformers Revenge of the Fallen over and over and over again, and the last person sitting there is the one who gets the part.
Well, that'll happen like maybe midway through the movie. Probably. I wouldn't get cast, but anywho. So, the 50 Shades of Grey movie, which we all know is shooting to be raunchy, and the screenwriter promises that it will be a raunchy NC-17 flick. Now it looks like they're still courting a director, they're trying to find directors. And Gus Van Sant, the director who is best known for Good Will Hunting and Milk, phenomenal movies. He's a very prolific director. He's a very smart director. He does fine quality pictures. Now, why he wants to direct this 50 Shades of Grey movie, I don't know. But we know this, and this is not really a rumor, because he actually went and he found 2 actors and he filmed a sex scene to prove that he is capable of taking on such a movie. So he actually filmed one of the sex scenes where, I guess, the lead girl or the main character, she loses her virginity, I guess, but it's a steamy sex scene from the book. And again, he shows this to, you know, to prove that he's the right director. And this is Gus Van Sant. This is, again, a prolific Hollywood, well-known director who wants to make 50 Shades of Grey. Could there possibly be some dramatic element to these books that would make it interesting to watch besides the sex? I don't know, and Matt will go watch it, and he'll let us know what happens.
I don't know. This whole thing just strikes me as awkward. I mean, I don't get it. I don't get it. I know you like Gus Van Sant. I know that we've had our differences and our agreements when it comes to both him and his films, but this one is just a little weird. I mean, I understand you really want to you really want to do something, and it's cool that you work in an industry where you can actually do something like, hey, look, film a scene. Let's go back to how Madonna got the part of Eva Perón or whatever her name is, and you know, she did a video with the bullfighter and all that crap, and she had that done specifically in that style so that she could turn that in as an audition tape, and that's how she got the part. So, I mean, I get that this is an avenue with which you can say, look, I can do it, see? Look, but to just go out of your way to film a sex scene just so that you can say you can film a sex scene, I don't know. I just don't know.
Again, we will have Matt go see the show when it comes out.
Yeah, so apparently I'm just going to have to go see. I'm going to watch every single disgusting frame twice.
In slow motion.
Exactly.
I'm sure your wife probably wants to go see it. Is she a 50?
Actually, you know what? I was surprised she did not get swept up in the 50 Shades of Grey phenomenon.
Did she get swept up in Twilight?
Which is why I was surprised that she did not get swept up in the 50 Shades of Grey thing. So, yeah, I don't know. It's weird. She hasn't read the book. She has no desire to get the book.
It might be a good thing, because that means she's not a lonely wife that is deprived of certain things. Therefore, she has to release certain fantasies and energy.
Well, hell, I'm starting to feel a little bit better about this already.
No, you're welcome. You're welcome, America.
Woo! Yeah.
World.
That's right. Look at me. I just got some husband points that I didn't even realize I could get.
Ching.
Woo! All right. So what else you got, sir?
All right. So the FTC reports, which I'm not too sure what FTC stands for.
Federal Trade Commission?
Hey, there you go. You know, that was a test. And you completed in flying colors. Now, the Federal Trade Commission came out with a report saying that the movie industry, or movie theaters, are doing a lot better. They're improving. They're enforcing movie ratings. So basically, not if you're not Tim Kuznyar and you don't speak in chopped up English like I do, and you can't understand it. That basically means that movie theaters are doing their jobs. They are keeping little kids from going into rated R movies, which is great. And they, in Hollywood, or the entertainment industry, actually has secret shoppers when it comes to movie theaters, which I had no idea until reading this, which thehollywoodreporter.com is where I got this information from. So there, it's apparently up 30% since 2000, and that is a big deal, apparently. So another tip of the hat to you, movie theaters, for going out of your way to do what you should have been doing for 40, going on 50 years, to regulate who sees what at the movie theater when it comes to little kids in rated R movies. Because as we know, for anybody who listened to Matt's rant from some episodes ago about going to the movie theater and there being a little kid there, or baby there, or something like that, going to a rated R movie, we all know that this is good news, and
yes, it
high
is.
Hopes for Matt in the future.
Yes, this is welcome. This is welcome information.
Indeed. And my last piece of news pertains to Schindler's List news. The little girl in the red coat, as we all remember from Schindler's List, because in the black and white movie, the only color was this girl's red coat. So she was kind of the sign of I guess, I don't know about hope, but she was the sign of
innocence?
Yeah, innocence. Thank you. She was a sign of innocence in the movie, and it's just a very pivotal point in your emotions while you're watching this particular moment of film. And if you haven't seen this movie, shame on you. You haven't got to see it before I move on. Now, this girl, who Schindler's List came out in 1993, and she finally saw, she actually saw the movie when she was 11 years old. So it was some time ago, and I guess somebody went and interviewed her or talked to her, and they said, oh, hey, by the way, I was horrified when I went and saw this movie, and that's exactly what happened. She was horrified when she went and saw when she finally saw Schindler's List, because at the time her parents wouldn't let her watch it. Steven Spielberg, in directing the movie, tried to keep it to where, because she was a child and there were other children on set, that they knew what they were doing, but they didn't know to what degree what was going on, that they were basically being led to their death in a Nazi Holocaust prison camp. And this is a quote from her. This is from Yahoo Movies. Quote, "I was ashamed of being in the movie and angry with my mother and father when they told anyone about the part," Dabrowski says, of her initial position on being in Schindler's List. Quote, "People said, it must be so important to you. You must know so much about the Holocaust. I was frustrated by it all," she added. So, she wasn't too... She didn't like the movie that much when she watched it. Poor girl. And now she's 23 years old and traumatized. And I don't think she didn't do a movie since then. Which oh. I guess if my first movie was a Holocaust movie, I might not want to do another movie.
You know, I'm sorry. I think this chick just needs to get the hell over herself. I mean, she was clearly treated, and rightly so, with kid gloves, to the point that she didn't even have a clue as to the seriousness of what it was that she was filming. She was just, you know, running and playing and doing whatever it was, and that's all that they did. And then she was being filed into a line, and that's all that she knew. So she didn't even come away with bad memories of it. It's not until later on that she finds out exactly what it was, and she's horrified. I mean, you know, I don't know.
When she was 11 years old, she was horrified. But what this article says, it says, "But now, Dabrowska's initial horror has turned into pride." Quote, "I had been part of something I could be proud of," she said of her current thinking on her iconic role. So, with age, with her in her 20s, now realizes that it's something she can be proud of instead of being horrified of being a part of. So, because I would imagine when you're 11 years old learning about that, it's kind of a shock, I'd imagine.
So, my news is interestingly related to Ben Stiller on both fronts. So the first one, and these are both also from Yahoo Movies, so that's kind of fun. We have Movie Line from via Yahoo Movies. And basically that Hollywood Reporter had said that Ben Stiller and his producing partner, Stuart Kornfeld, have commissioned screenwriter Clay Tarver to write a sequel to Dodgeball, A True Underdog Story. Now, the interesting thing here, the author here, Frank DiGiacomo, he believes that this would be a key public relations opportunity for the disgraced Tour de France cyclist. And basically what he does is, because as we all know from Dodgeball, you have the scene where Vince Vaughn is trying to quit, and Armstrong basically shames him back into going back and playing, right? And so now, of course, we know just exactly how retarded that statement is, because Armstrong had no, you know, is basically shamed himself. So he actually comes up, the author here of the piece has actually come up with a couple of setups here to help bring back Armstrong in a positive light. Both of these require him to kind of comedically take it on the chin, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because, quote, "The sequel is supposed to be about Vaughn's character and Stiller's character, White Goodman from Globo Gym, teaming up to battle an even bigger threat," end quote. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's basically going on saying that Armstrong's cameo could be as simple as having him seek redemption on LaFleur's team, or play for one of the competitors that Average Joe faces, right? And either way, The author believes that Armstrong should get beamed real good in a creative elimination scene. The other way that he was looking at it was that, quote, "even better, an encounter between LaFleur and Armstrong that would reference the first cameo. Once again, Armstrong would have to agree to take it on the chin. That could be deep and cathartic in a comedic way," end quote. And I think that would be pretty funny, because if LaFleur comes back and was like, "Yeah, thanks for that pep talk, you know, that you gave me all those years ago. It's great to see that, you know, you used blood doping to make yourself happy, you know, and all that kind of stuff." I don't know. I think if there's a good way that Vince Vaughn could make this happen, I'm pretty sure that they would.
Well, and this is something that you did speculate about some time ago. You did talk about that.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, because I had talked about that movie still from before. But it's interesting because the most recent thing that he's done is Lance Armstrong apparently was back on April 20th at the Austin Reggae Festival, he was drumming for the reggae band Lance Erbstrom. Yes, good. Going from one doping thing to another doping thing, I guess. But the closing statement, which I must agree with here from Mr. DG, DiGiacomo, is this, quote, "While we're on the subject of returning dodgeball characters, Jason Bateman's loopy ESPN 8 The Ocho color commentator Pepper Brooks is a must," end quote. And I completely agree.
You know, I completely forgot he was one of the commentators. Who was the other commentator? Because he played like the cool laid back guy, right?
Yeah, I can't remember. I just remember that his name was Cotton, because it's a risky move, Cotton. But it could work. So, yeah. Let's see here. So, second one here is from Movie Talk via Yahoo Movies. And this is from Mark Deming. And basically, this is kind of a story within a story. Because this story is actually about how Ben Stiller, he was talking with Ben Stiller, and Roger Ebert actually apologized for his initial Zoolander review.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yes. Roger Ebert gave a very harsh review of Zoolander when it first came out. And it's kind of funny because I love Zoolander. I think Zoolander is probably one of the best comedies I have ever seen in my life. It's just so completely outlandish and so completely ridiculous, but it's still just ridiculously funny. And from this story here, I come to find out that there's actually going to be a Zoolander sequel. So there's nothing really more specific than that, which is kind of terrible for news. But I just think it's really interesting because what happened was, is as everyone all remember, as we all remember, Roger Ebert definitely had strong opinions, and he was referenced by Ben Stiller recently at the Tribeca Film Festival. So it says, quote, "In a panel held Sunday at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York, Ben Stiller revealed that the late film critic apologized to him for an especially negative review he wrote in 2001. On September 28, 2001, just over 2 weeks after the 9/11 attacks, Ebert reviewed Zoolander, a comedy that Stiller wrote, directed, and starred in about a self-absorbed, dim-witted male fashion model. Ebert's pan was unrelenting, giving the film just one star. He began by writing, quote, there have been articles lately asking why the United States is so hated in some parts of the world. As this week's Exhibit A from Hollywood, I offer Zoolander, a comedy about a plot to assassinate the Prime Minister of Malaysia because of opposition to child labor. You might want to read that sentence twice," end quote. So, they go on to say that Stiller, as one might expect, wasn't happy with the review, and at the Tribeca panel he said with a laugh, "It seemed rather harsh to me." But that wasn't the end of the story. Stiller goes on, quote, "To his credit, I ran into him like 5 or 6 years later backstage at The Tonight Show," Stiller recalled. "He said, hey, I just want to apologize to you. I wrote that about Zoolander, and I now think it's really funny. Everything was a little crazy back then. It was September 11th, and I went overboard. I said," so Stiller replies by saying, "I said, quote, thanks for telling me backstage at The Tonight Show," end quote. So, I think it's really cool that someone who can go, you know, that Ebert was a man who was willing to go back and, you know, look at things in a different light.
Yeah.
And actually see if movies can stand the test of time. And it's neat that he went back to one that he gave a one-star rating to and then came back and said it was funny. The coolest thing about them is that essentially Stiller goes on to say that he tends not to read any of his reviews because he believes that, quote, it's the old adage, if you believe the good ones, you have to believe the bad ones, end quote. And I think that's something that's good to take care of, or to take with you. You know, you have to believe in what you're doing enough that you can be committed to it no matter what other people say. But the best part of this whole article was, quote, Stiller has a sequel to Zoolander in the works, and deep down inside, he may very well be relieved that Ebert is no longer in a position to critique the follow-up. End. So. That is my news.
Well, that's a very good piece of news to end on, I would have to say.
There we go. So, I think it's time for 3 Squared.
Or did you want to do that other segment?
Oh, wait, yeah. There was a whole other segment that I forgot about.
Okay, never mind. Okay. There are many lists online. Some of them are a little tedious to go through because some of them are stupid. Some of them are really funny, and these lists are ones that are kind of like, they'll say the 35 weirdest people in the world, for example, and you have to click through and scroll down, and you know, from 35 to 1 they have the weird people going up to number one, which are the weirdest people, and it's usually like a picture, and it says something about them, just kind of something to kill your time. I don't know, it's kind of ridiculous once you think about what they are. But this one is from whatculture.com, and this is basically the most expensive movies that we all hate. So it's five of them, so I'm just going to go down from this list. Again, it's from whatculture.com. The first one they have on here is, I, for the most part, agree with all of them. The first one is Evan Almighty, the sequel to Bruce Almighty, which cost them $196 million to make. And at that time, and I'm pretty sure, actually I'm pretty sure it still is, the most expensive comedy ever made. That budget is insane, especially in the 60s, when Blake Edwards did The Great Race with Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon. I mean, that was a big budget as well. But this, I mean, this is was insane. Especially since the tomato meter on Rotten Tomatoes, it only got 23%. And boy, this movie was bird poop. Did you see this one?
I mean, it wasn't funny. No, it did not look. It did not look very good at all, so I never saw it.
The funny stuff is in the commercials. You basically take the not-so-funny parts of Bruce Almighty, which I absolutely love Bruce Almighty, and you just make the entire movie based on those little bitty kind of punchline jokes. I mean, this one is definitely more kid-friendly than the first one. It's more crazy special effects than actually nuanced performances with witty dialogue. And of course, if nobody doesn't know, Evan Baxter has to build an ark, because he is told by Morgan Freeman that it's Noah's Ark story, pretty much. So, again, Evan Almighty for number five. Number four, they had Van Helsing, the Hugh Jackman movie and Kate Beckinsale, which is directed by Stephen Sommers, who did The Mummy in The Mummy 2. This one cost them $197 million to make, and again, this one is a 23% on Rotten Tomatoes. I actually, when it came out, I thoroughly enjoyed the movie, even though it was definitely special effects overload. It kind of goes to show that if you have too much in a movie, it ruins the movie. And you see a lot of movies that are still being made like this, even if it is a lot of special effects or not a lot of special effects. But if you have too many people or too many things going on in a movie, or with a superhero movie, if you have too many superheroes, like with Spider-Man 3, if you have too many villains in a movie, it takes away from what the movie should be about, or what's actually going on in the story. So you basically shoot yourself in the foot. And with Van Helsing, it's just crazy special effects, crazy action. I mean, it's an adventure movie, which every time he has to go fight a bad guy, or every time there's a fight scene, it's like one big adventure, where it's constantly music, there's no breathing room, it has some funny stuff in it, and some of the special effects is really cool, but it's diarrhea of special effects. It's diarrhea of rendering, I'll say. Now, the number three movie is the classic movie for being one of the biggest blows when it comes to box office movies ever, and this one is Cleopatra, which is the most expensive movie ever made. $330 million is what it cost to make this Elizabeth Taylor movie.
And is that adjusted for inflation, or is that the actual 1960s price?
Yeah, it's adjusted for inflation. The movie was initially budgeted at $2 million, and eventually it ended up costing them $44 million, which, according to whatculture.com, is a staggering 2,200% budget overrun. And what is classic about this movie is that it nearly bankrupted 20th Century Fox while this whole thing was going on. Or I guess 21st Century Fox. But it almost bankrupted that movie studio. It's insane. I mean, it's definitely kind of what it says on this website. It's one of the biggest overrun plague cinematic clusterfucks of epoch-shattering proportions.
Here's an interesting bit of trivia for you regarding Cleopatra.
Okay.
That is the first movie to ever pay any actor or actress $1 million. And it was because it was a joke.
Yeah, well, actually... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, what happened was that was supposed to... Cleopatra was supposed to be basically a tits and togas flick. Mm-hmm. And they wanted... Somebody said we should get Elizabeth Taylor to do this movie. And so they approached Elizabeth Taylor with this project. And she said, I'll do it for $1 million. Because no one would pay $1 million. And then they came back and offered her $1 million.
Again, Cleopatra with Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah, you gotta check it out. It's super long. And what's crazy is that they're wanting to remake it with Angelina Jolie. Which I kind of would like to see them remake the movie. Just to see if that one flops as well. Because it, regardless, if you make a Cleopatra movie, it has to be.
You know what? I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what. Give me the original $44 million, okay? And I'll save you the other $100-200 million you want to spend on this project. Just give me $44 million, and I'll give Angelina Jolie $10 million, and then she can say, "I'll be Cleopatra," and then I'll say, "Okay, cool." And then I'll film her dressed up as Cleopatra and give you that, and then shit on it, and then go, "Now let me there's your movie. It's just as bad, and I saved you $200 million. Thank you."
Now, will the behind the scenes featurette show you shitting on the film? And will you as well be dressed up?
Yes, in costume? Yes. I think I can find some extra room in that budget to dress up. Sure.
You have to find a lot of extra room in a lot of places, I guess. Yummy. So yeah, so number three there was Cleopatra. Number four is Michael Bay's Transformers 2 Revenge of the Fallen. This was a $217 million movie, and this definitely made back its budget, as you know, by the sequel, the fourth Transformers movie being in production, or starting to be in production. And this has a 20% on Rotten Tomatoes. And this is definitely, as everybody knows by now, this is the worst out of the trilogy of movies. So there you go. Now the fifth one, which is a huge disappointment. This is probably one of the first times I ever watched a movie with my father, and he took his hand and smacked himself in the face because, you know, I mean, he grew up watching Wild Wild West, and we love Kevin Kline and Mel Gibson, Will Smith.
That was an interesting one.
I know, right? Will Smith, you know, Men in Black. So, you know, it's going to have comedy. But this is a huge... This movie, the budget. I mean, God, $237 million is a lot of money for what that movie ended up being. I mean, hell, look at Transformers. $217 million. That was the budget for Transformers. Wild Wild West was $237 million. Where did all that money go? I would say to the stars and for the cool-looking CGI spider mechanical thing at the end of the movie. But yet, it didn't pay off. The movie did well at the box office, I am sure. But yeah, there you go. Again, they were Evan Almighty, Van Helsing, Cleopatra, Transformers 2, and Wild Wild West. Jim West.
Outstanding. So, are we ready then? Three squared? Three squared. For three squared, we are going to do our favorite martial arts action scenes that involve hand-to-hand combat. And so I have three films that I have chosen, three scenes from three films, and they are in order of my favorite to least favorite. However, my least favorite is a nostalgic one. So it's in and of itself, it's clearly not the best hand-to-hand combat scene, but it is an extremely nostalgic and important one, which fueled my desire to see other action movies and other martial arts movies, which allowed me to find the other two. So, number one, Ip Man, okay, which is the story of the guy that kind of more or less brought Wing Chun martial arts to the forefront of Chinese culture, and therefore even was the trainer of Bruce Lee. And there are actually two Ip Man films. Both of them are fantastic as far as I'm concerned. First one's better than the second one, but whatever. But there is a scene here that occurs roughly 25 minutes into the film, because the idea here is that it's set in the 1930s, and Ip Man is an independently wealthy guy. So even though he, you know, is a martial arts master, he doesn't feel the need to have a school or show off all the time or anything like that. However, there is a guy who comes in from one of the country provinces, and he feels that he has to he feels the need to show off in front of everybody and show just how badass he is. And after kicking some ass, he's basically told, "Yeah, well, you can't, you know, you're nothing compared to Ip Man. So he goes to Ip Man's house and basically is challenging this dude, challenging Ip Man right off the bat in his own home. And Ip Man is a, you know, wise man and not, he's very slow to anger kind of thing. And he's like, all right, well, if you insist, we'll fight somewhere else. And, you know, it's inside my house is a little, you know, there's nice things in here, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So the challenger then says, screw that, I'm getting you now. And then they have a fight in his house, and it's really cool because Ip Man is, like, just all over the place. It gets really cool and essentially puts Homeboy in his place. And it's just fantastic. It's close quarters combat because of the room that they're in. They do use some interactions between the stuff that's in the room, but nothing gets used as a weapon. So it's really just truly fantastic, excellently choreographed, excellently filmed, and the actors just do a phenomenal job of embracing their characters and the traits that their characters portray. So very, very highly regarded film. It is my favorite, hands down, martial arts scene where it's just hand to hand. Second one is 1995, Rumble in the Bronx. And I'm sorry, Ip Man came out in 2008. Just so you know there. Rumble in the Bronx, 1995 Hong Kong film. However, this was translated into English so that it could basically be the vehicle to get Jackie Chan in front of American audiences, which it's completely succeeded in doing. And it's set in the Bronx. However, it was filmed in Vancouver. So, you know, go figure. And basically, this is about a dude, Jackie Chan, who's a Hong Kong cop, comes to New York to attend a wedding of his Uncle Bill, and he stumbles onto a huge, like a huge conspiracy, and ends up having to pretty much save his family and then virtually all of New York, or the Bronx specifically, from the bad guys. So it's really kind of cool. You get to really see the creativity and the speed of Jackie Chan when he saves his family inside of a little supermarket. And he takes on like six guys inside of a supermarket, and it's virtually all hand-to-hand. He does utilize things in the room to get around and do acrobatic stuff. And I guess if you want to be technical, he does kind of use his jacket as a weapon a little bit, but still vastly hand-to-hand combat here. It's just absolutely awesome. That's just my favorite scene from the movie for the hand-to-hand side, but the whole movie is really quite good considering that it was a Hong Kong film, and so it was done basically from the point of view of how the Chinese like to have their films made. It was also 1995, and the reason that's this movie is basically the reason that Jackie Chan is a household name today. He had a lot of major hits, just like Bruce Lee and stuff, but they were all in China, and so there were fans, like my stepdad was one of them, who knew who he was before this movie, but he is a household movie, or I'm sorry, household name because of this movie, so excellent. Last but not least, 1984's The Karate Kid. Now, I know what you guys are thinking, what the shit? But just bear with me here. Now, there's nothing really spectacular about any of the martial arts in this movie, okay? But there is a scene, and it's the pivotal scene between Miyagi and Daniel. Okay, when Daniel is fed up with basically being his slave, with being Miyagi's slave, because he doesn't understand that he is being taught martial arts through repetition and hard work that is actually instilling in him a good work ethic and to be honorable in addition to the actual moves that he's learning. And so it all comes to a head, and then Miyagi comes at him. And, you know, it's like, show me wax on, wax off, show me paint the fence. And then he throws a punch at him, and then he throws a kick at him. And then all of a sudden, you get this, like, 20-second scene where Miyagi just completely comes at Daniel. And Daniel's able to basically completely fend off the attack because of all these moves. Now, this movie was in 1984, okay? I was 7 years old. This movie, that whole scene is to this day ingrained into my head, and it completely fueled the desire for me at that time, not just to learn karate, but to embrace all things martial arts. And so that is why I put this on my three squared list, because without this, I would not have a true appreciation for martial arts films for myself, because again, as a kid. But it just, that little 20 seconds right there is just kind of, even to this day, just kind of is like, wow, that's just really cool. And wouldn't it be amazing if you really could learn it that way? So, there you go. Ip Man, the challenge scene in his house. Rumble in the Bronx, supermarket scene. and Karate Kid, where Miyagi shows Daniel-san what's what.
Daniel-san. Cool. Okay, but before I mention these, I kind of have four, because I think there's a very fine line between visual entertainment in fight scenes and actual martial art talent. Like, which one is being shown on the screen. So the first two are more of the entertaining ones to watch because how they are presented in a visual stylistic way, as well as what their capability obviously is a big part of it as well. And then the second two, my last two, are sheer talent. All right, so the first one is The Matrix, Neo versus Agent Smith. There's a couple of these. Now, a lot of people like from the sequel, where he's trying to beat up all the clones that are coming after him, but eventually he picks a big pole and hits him off the big pole. But the one that I love is from the first one, is when they're fighting in the subway, Neo and Agent Smith. It's just really cool, really neat movie altogether. Cool cinematography and the special effects, just everything kind of worked out. But again, it is highly visual, and it kind of upstages the actual talent and the ability and the agility of an actor when it goes into hand-to-hand martial arts combat. Not saying that none of them trained, it's just from the visualistic standpoint. The second one is Oldboy, when Desuo fights this long line of bad guys, and they keep getting up, and he keeps getting the crap beat out of them, but he keeps beating them up, you know, one at a time, two at a time, and just goes on and doing it. And how it's shot is really cool. Again, it's very stylistic. It's just one long shot, and the camera just tracks the shot, just side, you know, one side to the other, and they're just kind of like in a hallway. It's, again, really cool shot. Visually entertaining. Now, again, the last two, which I think shows off actual martial arts talent when it comes to hand-to-hand combat. One is Jackie Chan. Now, the one that I chose, and again, Rumble in the Bronx was an excellent choice, Matt. I choose The Big Brawl, but it's also known as Battle Creek Brawl, which is a 1980 film, which is the first movie that was marked as Jackie Chan's first foray into American movies. Like, this was trying to get his name big. It was directed by Robert Klaus, as well as it included pretty much the entire stunt team and the effects team from Enter the Dragon. So it kind of has that same visual slash just entertaining fight scenes to it. And it's fun. And basically the movie is set in Chicago, Illinois, which was actually filmed in Texas during the 1920s. And he has to go into this big brawl competition where he has to fight for the mafia or to keep the mafia from killing somebody or, you know, something like that. But it's a good movie, entertaining. All of his fight scenes, because he's fresh and he's new and he's versatile with what he does. It's just something that this is the first time people actually saw him in America, other than his Asian films like Drunken Master, for example, which is my favorite foreign film of his, which I recommend both of them. The Big Brawl, which, great fight scenes, kind of a crummy movie, but Drunken Master, watch it for the comedy. For the action as well as the storyline is entertaining, and it's kind of a history lesson from those types of drunken fighting. And then last but not least is the Bruce Lee, because you just have to kind of mention Bruce Lee whenever you talk about these sort of things. Now, a lot of people keep referencing that Bruce Lee's best fight scene was between him and Chuck Norris, which I think people just say that because they have... People, a lot of people get wet for Chuck Norris for some reason. They just really like Chuck Norris, so anything with Chuck Norris is the best, regardless of what it is. However, my favorite is from Enter the Dragon, when Bruce Lee fights the leader of the island. His opponent has these razors on his hand, he has to fight them. So it's really cool. So again, my 3/4 are The Matrix, Oldboy, Jackie Chan, and Bruce Lee. And that's it.
Woo! That is what I'm talking about here. So,
it's the movies!
Yes! Alright, well, let's start off. Let's see, we were doing the comedy Rampart and Oblivion. So, let's start off with the comedy. And I'm going to say that while I certainly understand the idea behind why this movie was made the way it was made, and I guess I'm glad that art exists so that people can do what they feel is artistic in in their own way, but I'm also glad that we live in a world where I don't have to like it, because I did not like this movie.
You know, I kind of knew that when I chose it. I had a feeling.
Yeah. You were smart to play it the way you played it, because I would have made you use your one to see this movie otherwise.
But however, I do think it's good for people to be made to watch movies that they may not like, because either they may like it or end up liking it, or they might not. But I think it's kind of an important thing for people to watch things that they either don't feel comfortable to watch, or obviously depending on what kind of movie it is. I'm not a dictator or anything.
I don't know. Well, I mean, I see what you're saying, clearly, but on the same token, this isn't a movie that challenges you per se.
I think
this is not something that is thought provoking or something that is high art or something that's meant to even, again, to use the word challenge. I mean, it's not meant to challenge you. This is just basically the overuse of a trope that is the hipster to define the irony of how hipsters aren't as cool as they think they are.
Right, but it's the style, it's how the movie, how they did the movie, and how the movie kind of, the final product of the movie turned out. And to me, watching it, I thought it was different, and I, for some reason, which took me a while to think about why I enjoyed it, I enjoyed it. I don't know if you ever watched the Tim and Eric's show, Tim Heidecker and Eric Wareheim's show, which they do some weird comedy. So going into this, I knew something was going to be strange about it.
Tim, is this the one that's actually like called the Tim and Eric show?
Yeah, yeah.
And they like, it's on like Adult Swim or something at like 2 in the morning or something like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was on earlier 2 in the morning. I mean, I had never actually sat down and watched the whole show, but I mean, I've seen episodes and stuff of it. But it's a very different kind of comedy. So I knew going into it, since this has both of them in it, that this was going to be something different. And kind of like what Matt says, or had said, that this takes a look at the aging hipster and how what they think is cool, to most of us, it really isn't cool. Follows around this guy, played by Tim Heidecker, who kind of just goes around and just is an asshole. And is an asshole to random people for no really particular reason. It's just for some reason he just feels that he has money, and in some way he might be better than you and I or any other person throughout New York City. And that's why he does some of these things. As well as at the beginning of the movie, as we find out that his father is dying from some kind of, he's bedridden for some disease or whatnot. There is definitely some character development there. And I think this is just one of those movies that, I don't know, it's really hard for me to defend it, because I know exactly where you're coming from. It's just one of those movies to where you either hate it, or you find some entertainment in it, or you find something in the movie to enjoy. Not necessarily connect with, but it's just so odd, it's so different. And how the movie's put together with the tone and the mood of it. I think it has a really good indie New York underground soundtrack to it. Here, let me read what this says on Wikipedia. It says, despite the title, which is the comedy, and use of comedians as actors, Sundance Festival chief programmer Trevor Roth says that the film is not a comedy, but instead, quote, a provocation, a critique of a culture based at its core around irony and sarcasm, and about ultimately how hollow that is, end quote. And to me, I don't know, I enjoy some of these movies that, because they get made because they're able to be made, and I just like the idea they're making fun of themselves.
I look at it this way, it's like I said when we were doing show prep and stuff here before we started recording tonight, I look at it kind of like rubber without the explanation. And while we did agree, or while we disagreed on the placement of the explanation, we both agreed that the explanation was key to the enjoyment of the film. And I think that without any kind of explanation, it allows you to think whatever you want to think of it, and that's fine. But it kind of goes out like a bad Seinfeld episode. And I don't know. I think it could have done what it wanted to do without having to do it this way. So, I get it. I understand what they were trying to do. I can appreciate the fact that a movie like this can get made, but it's not my cup of tea.
Yeah. Well, I kind of think that whenever I see some of these guys, well, I mean, whenever I went to New York, I've definitely saw these guys around town, especially in around LA, you see these guys as well, to where none of them look happy. And just it's just kind of depressing to talk to these people because you can't say anything that can impress them. Not meaning to sound like, you know, I want people to be impressed by me, but, you know, it's just like, you can't really say anything to some of these people that really piques their interest. And in some ways, this is kind of like a look into their life and how ridiculous and kind of sad people they might actually be. But for some reason, this is how they want to be. I don't know. I guess that's how I defend the movie and justify it.
Okay, well then, so then, how many stars would you give this movie?
Well, and that's the thing. I might have to say 3 out of 5. It's just one of these movies that, you know, I mean, I'm sure you have some like this, where it's just kind of really hard to choose whether you kind of liked it or you did not like it at all.
So, okay, for you, then you would say that arguably the film is not necessarily a good film, but it is an important film.
I wouldn't even say it was important.
Okay.
I would say I think it's not important for the sake of the whole genre of movies, but I think for an indie movie that is going to be made about a particular type of person, I'd say this is a good movie to watch. If you've ever wanted to see how depressing the life of an aging, angry hipster is, then the comedy is the movie for you.
Fair enough. I think I can actually get behind that statement. That exact statement, I can get behind that. Yes. Okay, good. So, let's move along to Rampart then?
Yes.
Okay, so Rampart, I was concerned when I started to look into this movie that basically this was going to be just kind of like Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, but just kind of like instead of Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, it was just going to be Bad Lieutenant, somewhat loosely based on a story that happened in LA once upon a time. And the thing is that's exactly what it is, except it's what Bad Lieutenant should have been.
Bad Lieutenant.
This movie is fucking awesome.
I love Bad Lieutenant. How dare you? How dare you? To each their own.
This is true. Okay.
But the movie is good.
And at the end of the day, Bad Lieutenant Port of Call was not a terrible movie. Okay. I never said it was. I didn't like it as much as you did, but I'm not saying it's a terrible, terrible movie. But what I am saying is that this movie is what that movie could have been. I think this movie was just absolutely fantastic because this is kind of the loosely based on a true story in that there was probably once upon a time a bad cop in the Rampart division of the LA Police Department in the 90s. So because the Rampart Police Department did actually go through some trouble in the 90s. So there you go. So this is a movie basically about a bad cop who is happy, more or less, being a bad cop because it's all he knows. And yet, despite all of his flaws and all of his problems, he keeps one thing to himself to basically kind of keep him grounded, and that's his idea of family. That he has his own little world where he has his daughters and his wives. Not wives, I don't know.
He was married to both of them.
But it's not clear if he's divorced from the second one or not.
Yeah.
So you don't know where that particular relationship stands, but they all live together. And you can see he truly does love his daughters, and he truly does, for all of his flaws, he truly does at least strive to keep a singular family unit together. And it's that most of all for me that makes this movie. He has a relationship with food, that kind of like food equating to love kind of thing, where he refuses to eat. The whole movie, throughout the entire movie, you only see him eat one time. And throughout the entire movie, people are like, oh, Dave, you need to eat. You need to eat. He takes drugs like crazy. He drinks everything. Smokes, but he won't eat. And it's like he purposely denies himself nourishment, both physical and spiritual, for lack of a better term. He feels that he lets his world be controlled the only way he knows how, which is to just do it his way. And if his way is what society thinks is bad, well, fuck society, because I'm the cop and I'm the guy who's putting myself out there, and I'm the guy who's going to do it that gets the scum off the streets. Just like in Bad Lieutenant, you know, it all starts falling apart, and can he keep it together, or is he going to go down, and how does it all work out? And yet you watch this guy, and you watch him literally fall apart. This is the best acting I have ever seen of Woody Harrelson, ever.
And I was wrong. He was not nominated for an Academy Award for this one. It was an Independent Spirit Award.
He should have been. Yeah, he should have been. This, I mean, it's just a good movie. And it's got a lot of powerhouse actors in it, too. Robin Wright, Sigourney Weaver. Oh,
Sigourney Weaver?
Weaver. Sigourney Weaver.
Ned Beatty. Ned Beatty.
Yeah, Ned Beatty and what's his, the DA guy?
Oh, Ice Cube.
No, not Ice Cube.
Ben Foster's in it also.
Steve Buscemi.
Oh, that's right.
And that's actually one of the coolest scenes, actually, is Steve Buscemi and Woody Harrelson and Sigourney Weaver are all in a room together because they're discussing a case that involves Woody Harrelson and how it's affecting the department's image and stuff. And it just, instead of cutting to someone's face, or instead of doing the kind of slide thing like they did in that 70s show where they would, you know, everybody's getting stoned and they just kind of slide to one person and then slide it, the camera never stops revolving. And it just completely moves around in a circle for the whole scene. And it's drifting from person to person as they're talking. And you would think something like that would like make you dizzy or draw you away from it, but it doesn't, because it causes you to focus on what they're saying. It's just clever, clever shots. Like, the cinematography is fantastic. Every time that Ned Beatty comes in and Woody Harrelson, and they're together and they have conversations, because Ned Beatty plays a character who more or less is kind of like a grandfather, a favorite uncle figure to him, and Ned Beatty's pretty crooked as well, and they talk, you either see their face or you don't. And the way they'll do it is they would do a straight shot so that you could see the back of Ned Beatty's head as he's talking to Woody Harrelson, or vice versa. And they do it to an effect so that it's like letting you in but closing you out at the same time. And then they'll do a cross shot so that it's kind of coming in from the shoulder so that you can see Woody Harrelson's face, or from the opposite side so you could see Ned Beatty's face. But you never see them both at the same time for the bulk of their conversations. And it's almost as if the director is playing a game with you to keep you in but keep you out at the same time. Kind of like how they have to play the game with each other. And it's just things like that throughout this entire movie that are just absolutely fantastic. And the movie is just awesome. I thought I was not going to like it or merely tolerate it, and I was gladly wrong. This movie is fantastic. 5 stars.
I agree with you completely. However, God, I do love Bad Lieutenant Porter Call New Orleans. I don't know. I'm just stuck thinking about that right now. But yeah, no, Rampart is... Woody Harrelson did deserve an Academy Award nod. Especially, we don't see him in enough movies where he gets to shine like he does here. I mean, other than People vs. Larry Flint, which he was nominated, and then he was also nominated for The Messenger, which came out... Oh, I think that was 2009, 2010, and it was by the same director, so that might be something to check out as well. But yeah, no, Rampart is definitely an interesting character observation, and it's cool living in L.A., and you'll hear him talking about certain places, and you'll catch his little jokes where he's telling his daughter, who took it, you know, who likes to ride the bus, I guess, because she thinks she's, you know, feeling independent, she's the rebellious one, and he made a crack like, don't go east of La Brea. And it's funny because I just live like one block away from La Brea on the west side. So I was like, man, you know, back in 99, I guess, you know, this is really shady area of La Brea or something. So, I mean, it's just a very interesting movie. And it's just amazing watching this movie, then going back and doing some research and hearing about all this stuff that was happening during the early 90s. And then hearing about the stuff on the news kind of died down once the terrorist attacks kind of started ramping up and the war in Iraq kind of going on. So this kind of like left the news cycle after a while. And then you look at cops now, and a lot of cops have totally toned down because of the Rampart investigations and all that stuff. So it's just, it's very interesting watching this bit of piece of history from the LAPD from that time. And I think they captured the mood of it, and the, you know, just how like these particular cops with these particular character traits, how they act. You know, they don't think they're doing anything wrong. They're assholes, and they're hard asses, and they do all these things, but they try to talk themselves out of it. And it's amazing because you see people try to talk themselves out of a lot of things, not just with stuff like that, but just with, you know, if they could be the biggest liar, they can be Rupert Murdoch, and make themselves look superior than the guy next to them. And people will not necessarily believe them, but they'll just kind of push him off to the side and just say, well, just let him do what he's always been doing. They would just look the other way from it. They would just look the other way. And, you know, that's how a lot of people like this, they get off of criminal charges, or they get away with doing a lot of things because of how they present themselves and how they handle a situation, which is what happens with Woody Harrelson, is that when he beats the crap out of that guy who hits him with the car, because he thinks he's doing he thinks he's doing the right thing. Not too long after that, he ends up shooting two people, and then he's back in the limelight for something else. So he keeps screwing himself over. It's amazing how many people out there are kind of like him, and who are all probably still doing their jobs as a policeman, even though they, you know, they did stuff like this. Well, you know, we'll never know. So I think it's an important movie in some regard, if not in filmmaking, but in expressing the part of history where there were crooked cops, and a lot of them did not get away with some of the things that they did that were crooked. So check it out.
But I also think that it's important because there is an underlying element that we, as the contributing members of society, more or less, and law-abiding citizens, where we say that, to a certain degree, we turn the blind eye to what the police are doing. Because we say, you know what, if they're keeping us safe, then out of sight, out of mind. So what if they beat up somebody that maybe they shouldn't beat up? If they get the drugs off the street, or if they stop the bad guy, is that okay? And while it should not be okay, once again, we allow them to represent us.
Right.
And we allow them, and we can turn a blind eye to what they do as well. And I think that that's also something that's very important that this movie talks about.
Roger Ebert's review of this movie, which I gotta point this out. Quote, he, Woody Harrelson, reminds me of one of the most evil characters in American fiction, Judge Holden in Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian. A man who likes to torture and kill for no other reason than simply to cause pain. The Harrelson of Rampart could play Judge Holden, and not many actors could. End quote. And I think that also adds to why this movie is so good, because it's definitely a character movie. And the character would not be as entertaining to watch, or be as provocative, or as have such an impact if it wasn't Woody Harrelson playing the role. Because he just has, Woody Harrelson just has this way of playing an asshole, or playing an aggravated jerk, or even playing a nice guy. You know, even with Kingpin, when he plays Roy Munson and he loses at the end, you still kind of feel bad for him. Woody Harrelson, he just has this way about himself that you can either hate him, you want to punch him in the face, or you just want to give him a hug. So, who knows? Could be all that oxygen intake.
All right, well then I guess, so we both thoroughly enjoyed Rampart.
Indeed.
Yes. All right. So, last but not least is Oblivion, which is the new Tom Cruise science fiction flick. And it takes place in the year 2077. 60 years earlier, Earth was attacked by aliens, and eventually, though we won the war, it was a Pyrrhic victory. The planet was pretty much toast, and the only beings left on the face of the planet are the scavs, which is short for scavengers, who try and take the remaining resources and stuff. And then, of course, there are the caretakers. And so these caretakers are basically teams of two people, which are pretty much just a few people left on the face of the planet, who keep the drones up and running, and are basically, they work for periods of time, and we're down to two people left. Technician 49, Tech 49 Jack Harper, and his communications officer and partner and lover, Victoria. And they have 2 weeks left before they're done. They get to go out to Titan, which is the largest moon of Saturn, which is where the remainder of humanity has been taken to. They only have one method of communication with the outside world, and that's with the spaceship Tet, which hangs out in orbit. The reason why the Earth was more or less destroyed was because the first thing that the bad guys did was they blew up the moon. And if you blow up the moon, we have no tides, earthquakes, all sorts of crap happens, and that's what happened. So, the thing is that Jack has these flashbacks, and he doesn't tell anybody about them or anything, but you know, it's just like, man, he doesn't understand why he has to leave. He really loves this place, and he finds, even though it's a desolate world, he's kind of made a little space for himself that only he knows about. And what ends up happening is that the Scavs end up kidnapping him. The problem is the Scavs, which are supposed to be the bad guys, are humans, which is now kind of flying in the face of everything that Jack knows. And yet somehow he kind of has a feeling that these humans aren't lying to him. So who exactly is Jack working for? And that's kind of where the movie takes off. There's quite a few twists and turns. To a certain degree, most of them are predictable, but the story itself is just really kind of cool. It's a soul-searching kind of movie with enough action to keep you going and keep the blood pumping. Amazing special effects, but it's not a special effect-driven movie. Really, this is one of the better acting jobs that I've seen Tom Cruise pull off in quite some time. The real show stealer, though, is Andrea Riseborough, who plays Victoria. I'm telling you what, man. Not only is she hot, and not only is just her accent and her very wonderful body enchanting, the character she plays, it's awesome, because while it's clear that she cares about Jack, she is diametrically opposed to him in the way that she thinks and looks at things. And they both care about each other, but when it comes down to brass tacks, will they back each other? It's just amazing to see that dynamic play out, because it's like, you know, the train wreck is coming, and they both know the train wreck is coming, but neither one of them wants to get away. What was the movie that we watched a couple weeks ago where they stayed together because they didn't want to hurt each other? Sleepwalk with Me.
Yeah.
Okay, it's much like that, only everybody's just waiting for this train wreck to happen. And when it does, I'm not going to spoil it for you. You're like, wow. And yeah. I'm sorry?
I said, good, I'm glad, because I really want to see this now.
Yes, so, and then when the train wreck, you're like, oh, wow. And then they start just dumping the surprises on you. And again, most of the surprises are predictable, but whereas they're predictable, it's not like you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop, but because they're predictable, it just kind of makes it easier to go with the flow, so you don't have to think about the movie too much. And it just kind of lets the story unfold on its own, and it makes it just absolutely fantastic. And honestly, the person that I thought I would like the most in this was Morgan Freeman. And quite frankly, could have gone either. Could have really just done without him. He neither adds nor takes away anything in this movie. So, because of the predictability of the movie, I took a half a star away from it. Because really and truly, this movie is really, really good. And though it is predictable, I still gave it 4.5 stars because it's beautiful to look at. And quite frankly, Tom Cruise surprised me with how good he could act in this movie. I've not been all that impressed with him as of late. He kind of seems to ebb and flow, and this seems to be going towards the flow. So I gave it 4.5 out of 5 stars. I was very happy to see this movie in the theater, and there you go.
Wow, Matt, sounds like you really enjoyed that movie. Well, I'm glad. You know, other than the comedy, this was actually a pretty good week of movie watching for us. Now, before we close the show, I'd like to take a couple minutes to talk about my grandfather. For those who listened to last week's show, you'll know that I was in Houston, where I was able to record with Matt. However, I wasn't just in Houston to record with Matt. I was there to see my grandfather before he passed away, and eventually he did pass away. So I would just like to take a couple minutes to tell you about him. Oh, what a beautiful morning! My grandfather, Dale Anderson, was born in August of 1933. He had the childhood that many of us never had. He had two parents that were fantastic. His mother, my great-grandmother, played the piano, so he grew up listening to beautiful music constantly. To where, when he discovered that he could sing, that he had that talent of singing, the family would all get together and watch him perform alongside of his mother on the piano. So he had a very close-knit family. But however, when he was still young, there were two movies in particular that inspired him in his imagination to become a filmmaker, to become a singer, to become the family man that he was, to become the inspiration that he was to me and to others that were friends of his as well as family members. And those movies were Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, that came out in the mid-30s, and The Wizard of Oz, which came out in 1939. Now, with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, my grandfather was just amazed by the color and the depth that movie had for an animated movie. Like, he couldn't believe what Uncle Walt achieved in entertainment. He was just amazed by this. The use of storytelling with characters and with music. And to this day, one of the last conversations I had with him, which I was telling him about doing the podcast and what we have, one of the Three Squared segments, were our three favorite music scores. And he told me that the one movie that has some of the best music in it is Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So that is one movie that he loved. And with Wizard of Oz, he was just terrified, as well as amazed, by that damn tornado that just rips through Kansas. Again, he couldn't believe that this medium of motion pictures could achieve such a caliber of horrific entertainment.
My romance doesn't have to have a moon in the sky. My romance doesn't need a blue lagoon standing by, no month of May, no twinkling stars, no hideaway.
Other than those movies, he was inspired by numerous other things. For instance, he loved Mario Lanza. To him, there was not a better entertainer or singer out there than he was. And with me growing up, he would sit me down and have me watch The Student Prince, which Mario Lanza only sung in. It was Edmund Pardum who acted in the movie, but Mario Lanza was the singing voice for him. There was The Great Caruso, as well as Toast to New Orleans with Mario Lanza and David Niven. I would spend a lot of time with him. He would sit me down and have me watch these movies just to help me expand my mind. And with those movies, there were Indiana Jones. I mean, I would not be involved as much in movies if it wasn't for this man, especially with my love of Indiana Jones and adventure films. I mean, with the movie serials that he grew up watching with Batman and Superman and these adventure flicks that Indiana Jones was indeed based on, he wouldn't have given me the inspiration to do what I am doing now, writing and talking about movies with having this podcast. There would not be an SLS cast with Matt and Tim if it weren't for my grandfather. But also, with the appreciation of film, he also taught me that you don't have to be vulgar to be funny, to be liked, and that the best comedy comes from wit and personality. It's like Monty Python, John Cleese, Eric Idle, Michael Palin, all those guys. He loved them. He loved Carol Burnett, because even with her is that you don't have to be vulgar and just filled with disgusting innuendos to be liked, to be funny. I mean, it was just all about personality and wit and charm. That's another reason why he loved Mario Lanza. It was because of his charm, how he exposed himself to people. He was liked for a good reason. Other performers that I discovered through him were Dean Martin and Ricky Ricardo. Now, yes, Ricky Ricardo from I Love Lucy. My grandfather told me that the only reason why he ever watched I Love Lucy was not for Lucille Ball in her crazy, goofy, red-headed antics, but it was for Ricky Ricardo. Every time Ricky Ricardo sang, made the show worth watching. And I look back and I watch those episodes now, and without Ricky Ricardo, there wouldn't have been an I Love Lucy. I mean, Ricky Ricardo was Lucille Ball's second half. But it's funny, a lot of people don't look at it that way. They just look at it as a one-man show. And that's the type of thing that my grandfather exposed me to. Good movies and excellent entertainer. He's the one that taught me what it took to be a good performer, to give my best performance.
you laugh at my jokes too much. People will say we're in love.
Whenever I first started doing theater, I had a hard time landing roles. I had a hard time getting the lead or getting the supporting lead. That I would just be, you know, I would just have a character that had a few lines. Especially whenever I was in musicals, I couldn't sing worth crap. I didn't inherit that quality of him. So I was always in the chorus, or always only had a bit speaking part, talking part in musicals. But he taught me this little anecdote, or this little line to live by, that there are no small parts, only small actors. He was a very optimistic guy, even up until his death, who he actually beat the cancer he had, but he always looked forward to living and traveling. A couple more things to mention about him, before I wrap this up, is that he wasn't always a singer or a filmmaker. He first started off as being a lifeguard. Now, my grandfather was a good-looking guy. He always had a great set of hair on him. I mean, that was one of his many great qualities. And that's one thing that he taught me, is never cut my hair. Enjoy the hair that you have. Let it flow. But at that swimming pool, he had a lot of women that gawked all over him. But he wouldn't settle for them, because he already had his one true love, his life partner for over 60 years, my grandmother, Patty Anderson. And at that time, she was Patty Lawrence. They met in high school. They married at the tail end of high school, very young. But it goes to prove that love can stand the test of time. If you truly love somebody, if you truly get along with them, it can work. I mean, look at my grandparents. Look at your grandparents, even. I mean, it's just phenomenal. After the lifeguard job, my grandfather was a fashion show announcer at a bowling alley. Yes, bowling alleys at that time, throughout the 50s, were not just used to bowl. They would have fashion shows, weekly fashion shows on Friday or Saturday nights. And they were looking for a good-looking host that can present and make not only the ladies look good, but make the establishment look good. And that was my grandfather. So my grandfather announced fashion shows for a while. He was also a performer for an opera company in Houston called the Summertime Light Opera Company, where he performed in various operettas. In doing that, he's met a number of fantastic people that have gone on to do bigger and better, amazing things. He's also traveled all around the world doing industrial films and tourism movies. He filmed in Paris, he filmed in Rome in the Colosseum. He's been wine and dined by royalty. He even traveled to the heart of Congo, where he spent Thanksgiving one year. He did industrial films for big wig oil companies. He did tourism movies for the Alabama Coushatta Indian Reservation, as well as Caesar's Palace. And most recently, he won a Telly Award for producing and directing a tourism video for the Caves of Sonora in East Texas. But like I said before, there really aren't a lot of people out there that enjoy the simpler things, the finer things in life. I know that, especially living out here in LA, people take things for granted. But whenever I was a kid, during Christmas time, we would have the Christmas tree up with all the lights, the colored lights, and we would spend 30 minutes to an hour every Christmas Eve just laying up underneath the Christmas tree and just looking at lights. He taught me the value of lights, of being able to see beautiful colors, of being able to see beautiful scenery. He taught me that whenever I film a travel video, or even whenever I go on vacation, I just have my own home video camera, my home personal video camera, and I'm shooting the hotel I'm staying in, is that you take your time. You don't move the camera around, you establish your shot. Because what's the point of watching something if you can't look at it and enjoy it? The first movie that he ever took me to was Dragonheart. The last movie I saw with him was Super 8. The last book he read was a book that I gave him. It was a book about James Cameron, which was kind of fitting because James Cameron himself was inspired by many of the same things as my grandfather. My grandfather was born in August of 1933. He passed away Sunday, April 14th of 2013. On that night, we lost an award-winning actor, singer, and filmmaker. He was a best friend, a second father, and my original partner in crime. He was my papa. Dale Anderson, my loving grandfather, he will be missed. Nobody will be able to forget his kind sense of humor. I know that from here on out, I will never walk alone. He will always be there by my side every step of the way. These classic movies I would like to recommend are not only Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs or The Wizard of Oz, because I know most of us have already seen them, but these Mario Lanza movies, The Student Prince, Toast to New Orleans, and The Great Caruso. Hope you guys enjoy.
Okay, that's really cool. Way to go, Tim. Good job, sir. So I guess then I think that kind of closes us out, does it not?
Yes, it does. I do believe so.
Very good. Okay, so the 3 squared for next week, guys, is going to be your favorite trilogy. It cannot be Star Wars, and it cannot be Indiana Jones, and it cannot be Lord of the Rings, okay? Really and truly, it shouldn't be The Godfather either, but since we didn't set that up in the original rules, I guess I'm going to leave that one out there floating around. The movies we're going to be watching next week. We're going to be watching 42, Pain and Gain, and Headhunters. So we're going to be checking those out. And I guess that's time for the spiel, is it not, Mr. Tim?
That it is.
Very, very good, then. All right, so the music, as always, that you have been listening to has been brought to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can check them out at reverbnation.com. Go to Houston, look for Cries of Solace. You can also check them out at facebook.com and myspace.com, both/Cries of Solace. And you can check us out at slscast.com. You can also send us email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter @theslscast. And of course, go to Facebook and get on with the SLS Cast. So, until next week, when we officially turn 21. That's right. I'll make it funny, damn it. I'm going to make it funny.
What's going to be?
You guys have a great one.
What's going to be our first drink?
I don't know, but I think we should drink. It's been a while since we've been drinking on our show.
Okay.
Guys, this is going to be a great episode coming up. All right, we'll see you next week, guys. Thanks a lot.
All right, take care. Cheers.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.